Good evening. Thank you so much for being here. You're in for a treat. I've listened to Judy today at two functions, lunch and an event just now, and special. Let's leave it there. That they're very frugal with water. We're going to split this glass.
I have a feeling a glass is going to be rushed out here shortly.
But actually, this is vodka, so it's plenty. Thanks for being here. Welcome to Montana. Special pleasure to see you here.
It's great to be here. It's great to be back in Montana, and I love the idea that we're bringing the Yellow Jackets and the Grizzlies together. I love that, you know, with Montana PBS.
Bobcats, actually.
Bobcats,
the Yellow Jackets.
I knew I was going to get it wrong.
She spilled the beans. There's going to be a rebranding of the Bobcats to the Yellow Jackets, and their investigative reporter has found that out. Again, thank you. Now, one small comment on your itinerary. You've been here two times. Is that correct?
Well, that's right, and for public broadcasting.
I see, because there's a rule. If you come back again, you're here for more than a few days. There's a lot to see. We want you to see it.
There's so much more to see. And when I first came for public broadcasting, I was in Missoula.
Really?
At University of Montana.
I see.
And then worked my way down to Billings on that trip. So I was here for a couple of days. But this trip is too short. I'm only here for a day and a little bit more. So.
A week is about right, minimum.
At least a week.
At least a week. All right, we've got a deal then. Okay, let's start our conversation. Where did you grow up? What did your folks do?
Where did I grow up? I grew up all over the place. I was an Army brat, born in Tulsa, Oklahoma. My mother was from southwestern Missouri. She was born in Springfield, moved to Tulsa as a little girl. My father had grown up in Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina, small town. Joined the Army at a very young age. In fact, he lied about his age to get into the Army.
When was this, Judy? When approximately did he join the Army?
I would say in the late 30s. He was born in 1921.
Okay.
So he probably, I think you were supposed to be 17 or 18, and he was actually only 15 or 16. So he was a year or two ahead before he should have joined. But neither one of my mother did not finish high school. She had been, her father died when she was 14. She came from a large family. When her father died, she stayed home to help her mother raise her siblings. Her mother took three jobs to continue to support the family. And so I have to say, I give so much credit for anything I've ever been able to do to my mother, because what I heard the entire time I was growing up was, get an education, get your education, finish school, and then you can make decisions about what you want to do with your life, because she had, as I say, had never even been able to finish high school. So I was born in Oklahoma, in Tulsa. When I was 5 years old, my father was assigned to Mannheim, Germany. We moved to Germany for 3 years, started school there, came back to the United States. He was assigned to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. We lived in Missouri for a year. That's where my sister was born, Anita. Then we moved to, he was assigned to Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. So we lived in Red Bank, New Jersey for a little less than a year. Then he was assigned to Taiwan. This was in the late 1950s.
So you were with him?
Well, we did not go at first because dependents were not allowed to go. And so my mother and sister and I moved back to Tulsa to be near my mother's family. We stayed there for a while. I finished half a year of school. Then we joined my father in Taiwan. We stayed there 2 years. And then my father was assigned to Fort Gordon, Georgia. He was in the Army in the Signal Corps. There was a major Signal Corps headquarters in Augusta at Fort Gordon. But instead of going straight to Augusta, it was in the middle of a school year, so my parents sent me to North Carolina to live with my grandparents. So by the time I got to Augusta to start or be in the middle of seventh grade, I think it was, I know it was, I had been to seven different schools by seventh grade.
I read that in your biography,
Yeah. And
I appreciate that.
So it's probably part of the reason I wanted to go into journalism.
That's what I wanted to ask you. That's kind of moving around, seeing different parts of the world. Did that influence you in any respect?
At the time, all I could think of when I was growing up was I was never going to marry somebody in the military, because that meant you had to move a lot and you had to get shots all the time. I had a very parochial perspective on it. I love seeing the world. I had great memories of making friends in Germany and Taiwan, of seeing both of those countries, especially so Taiwan. We traveled, I was a Girl Scout in school classes. We traveled around the island nation of Taiwan. And of course, that was at a volatile time in Asian politics, if yes. you will, because of course, Chiang Kai-shek had fled, had been kicked out of China. There was this ongoing enmity and worse between him and the Chinese leadership.
Yep.
And it was at a time, for those of you who are, most of you are not as old as I am, you won't remember this, but there were the tensions in the strait, the Formosan Strait, where the Chinese were threatening Quemoy and Matsu. We were there at about the same time that was going on. So it was a very tense time.
I can tell you're used to an hour show, but I've been told this is a half-hour program, or they're going to.
And you want to get past the seventh.
Take me out.
You want to get past the seventh grade? Okay. All right.
So, in a nutshell, from your perspective, that experience growing up internationally, did it affect your awareness of the world, your interest in the world?
It absolutely made me more interested in the world. I grew up seeing that places were different, people were different. I remember being. I rode in a pedicab. We would pay the driver, I don't know, a dollar or two to take me from our house to wherever it was in downtown Kaohsiung, Taiwan, to go to my Girl Scout meeting.
Yes.
No one went with me. I went by myself. I was in the sixth grade. It was just a completely different time. When we moved to Augusta, my parents put me on a bus, a Trailways and then a Greyhound bus, to ride to visit my relatives in Oklahoma. I remember doing this when I was 12, 13 years old and didn't think anything about it. Today, you would never dream of putting a 12 or 13-year-old
girl. We might get around to talking about why that change has taken place, because it's obviously a very significant change.
It's a huge change, but that ability to see the world, to experience the world on my own, I'm sure some of it had to inform what I wanted to do later.
When you were in college, you got a degree from Duke. You started in political science at some point and then changed, is that correct?
I started actually in math. I couldn't figure out what I wanted to do. I tested well on the SAT. Would anybody like to know my SAT score in math? No, just kidding. In any event, my teachers in high school said, you know, you ought to think about majoring in math. I did. I signed up for math, but when I got to college, I found out that the professors didn't think women should be taking calculus.
We can talk about that too.
I don't want to mess up the plan here, Ryan. But I at some point I realized that I was more interested in political science than I was in math. I switched majors. I was at Small Women's College in Raleigh, North Carolina, called Meredith. I had wanted to transfer to Duke. I got into Duke as a junior. In a hurry to get in all those courses so I could graduate in another 2 years. I studied political science, graduated with a degree in political science, thought I was going to go to work in Washington. I had worked as an intern for my congressman in Washington.
Yes, now a couple of things I'd like to ask you about that. First, we're talking about the era of civil rights movement, the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
We're roughly the same age. That's actually a mistake. It says we're the same age, but she's obviously 25 years younger than I am. You can just tell by the appearance. In any event, you will remember the civil rights movement in Vietnam.
Absolutely.
Was that a part of your frame of reference in being interested in public policy?
No question. When I was a senior in high school, when I was trying to decide what I wanted to major, you have to remember there were very few women role models around. My mother said to me, get an education, but she said, you pick what you want to do, whatever you're interested in. I looked around. The only women who were working outside the home, which I honor a great deal, I honored my friends and women I knew then who were stay-at-home moms and what we then called housewives. But I wanted to do something else outside the home. I looked around. Women were teachers and they were nurses and secretaries. I had a good friend whose mother was a secretary in an insurance firm. And I thought, okay, what are the options there? I had one friend who had a mother who was worked in the county treasurer's office. And so I thought, well, maybe there are some opportunities for women in government that don't exist in the private sector. Mm-hmm. You didn't see women running businesses very often. And so probably that played into it. When I was a senior in high school, I started to say President John Kennedy was assassinated. that November of my senior year. That was a searing moment for me. I remember sitting on the floor of our living room watching on black and white television for days as Walter Cronkite narrated the assassination and then the funeral and burial of John Kennedy. And I remember thinking, what is our country coming to? And then as I was a senior in college 4 years later, I'm at Duke, that April, Martin Luther King is assassinated, and then right after I graduate, a week or two later, Bobby Kennedy is assassinated. I'm truly thinking at that point, what is the country coming to? Is this a safe, are we in a safe place? And what can I do to help? My interest in journalism, my interest in public life was all about how can I help? I remember John Kennedy saying, ask not what your country can do for you, what can you do for your country? And I'm sure that I, like millions of other young people who were growing, coming of age at that moment, baby boomers, were thinking the same thing. What can we do? How can we help? It was Vietnam. The Vietnam War was beginning to rage in the late 60s. It would be much worse in the next year or two. And of course, the civil rights movement. I would like to tell you that I was infused with the heat of the civil rights movement, that righteous sense that something terribly wrong had happened. I will tell you that having been an army, a military brat, I went to school with kids of all backgrounds. I went to school with African-American children, we call black children. And then I got to Augusta, Georgia, and schools were completely segregated. I went to schools where the blacks went to one set of schools and whites went to another. And I thought there was something terribly wrong with that, but what could I do as one person other than think this is wrong? Georgia was racked at that time with the civil rights movement. The woman who would go on to be my great good friend at the NewsHour, Charlene Hunter Gault, in the early 60s integrated the University of Georgia. She and Hamilton Holmes were the first two African Americans to try to enter the University of Georgia. She suffered not just boycotts and marches, but people threw rocks and tomatoes and eggs at her in her dorm room, threw things at the window. She ended up leaving the University of Georgia after a few months, stayed away for about a year, and then did come back, finished, and got her degree. All that was going on while I was in high school. She's a couple of years older than I am. And I told her later that I was mortified, embarrassed, deeply inadequate, that I wasn't more engaged and involved as a high school student and then later as a college student in North Carolina while she was going through that. And we would go on to be colleagues in journalism at the NewsHour, that I wasn't more involved and aware. It wasn't part of my life in Augusta. And I can hardly explain why, except to say that my parents were not very political.
Now, if you look at the question of your journalistic career, and I recommend everybody in the audience, start with Wikipedia, and you'll find the footnotes. There are 85 footnotes to what's your summary.
There's a lot wrong with the Wikipedia.
Okay, well, I'm sorry about that, but the footnotes show the incredible accomplishments. I was impressed is an understatement. Now, part of the discussions that have happened today are, quote, objectivity in news, and you've made the point that you stick with the news as the facts and what you think people need to know, my summary, and you'll expand on that. But my question is, with this background, there has to be some sort of value that orients you to what is important in the news. In other words, you speak with passion about the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War. Does that influence judgment about what people need to know? Because that's a value judgment.
It's not an easy thing to unpack what one's own value system is. In fact, it's probably almost impossible to honestly unpack where do our values come from. The only thing I can do is look back at my life and think about what I saw, what I witnessed, what I experienced, and I think about how that came together. And I've mentioned a few of those things that deeply affected me. Growing up in a family of relatively modest means, a military family, traveling around. My mother came from a very modest background, as did my father. My father's father worked in a paper mill in Roanoke Rapids for his entire life. He died of lung disease from having been in that paper mill at the age of 65. My mother's father, as I mentioned, died when she was 14. She left school to raise. All of that informed me, the sense of that people struggle, that things are not handed to you. And I've kept that with me my entire life. Even though I was not engaged in marches or advocating for during the time of the civil rights movement, I've always felt that that was a righteous and overdue thing in American life. I've felt that. It just came from the inside of me. I don't know where it came from, because both my mother and father grew up in segregated communities. My father in North Carolina, my mother in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Missouri. So I picked it up somewhere. It must have been moving from Army base to Army base and being with children of all different kinds of backgrounds. So that's part of it. But another part of it, I truly think it was growing up and being jolted by what happened in the 60s and realizing that my generation could make a difference. At my graduation year at Duke, students sat in on the campus to advocate for non-academic employees to make sure that they had a minimum wage. That was something that I felt was important. I wasn't an organizer, but I believed in what they were doing, and I sat out on the campus for that. That was the first time I had ever marched or sat in or sat out or whatever you want to call it for a cause. And I didn't go on to be somebody who was an activist. I chose journalism because I felt journalism could be a way to shine a light on some of these injustices, on some of the problems that need fixing, on our public officials who should be held accountable. I felt journalism was a way I could help people understand what's going on around them and help them figure out ways to get what they need to have to be good citizens and to contribute to society. I mean, that's what drives me. It drives me every day. I want to know that people who don't have the ability to speak up, who don't have the ability to help those in their own family get a good education, get enough food on the table, that they can find a place to get that information, to get that help. That's what drives me.
That's a very significant statement. I've interviewed Supreme Court, not candidates, we have elections for the Supreme Court in Montana, and the question comes up, do the person's values and experience in life affect court decisions? Now, the knee-jerk answer is no way, the law is the law. But in fact, they will all tell you, yes, it affects them. And I'm hearing you say that your life experience affects, tell me if I'm going too far, which stories over a period of time you decide people should hear about? Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. I mean, I think I'm having said that, Brian, yes. I'm constantly trying to listen to people. I mean, it's easy for me to say that. I live and work in Washington, D.C. I love being here in Montana. Am I out and around the country all the time? No, I'm usually in Washington. But I do read what people write to us. I travel when I can. I try to visit different parts of the country. I certainly, in fact, I make it a point several times a year to get out either because of public broadcasting, to try to speak or participate in a community gathering different parts of the country. I think that's important. I try to get out for reporting. That has increasingly gotten difficult because of my role at the NewsHour. My point is that I don't ever want to get to a place where I feel like I've got it figured out. I kind of know what the important stories are, I know what people need to know, and I don't really need to listen anymore. I never want to feel that way. I feel when I wake up every morning, I need to be listening. I need to be paying attention because people are out there saying, hey, this is wrong. There's been an injustice here, or something's gotten out of balance here. Our public officials aren't serving us well here or there. Or, I mean, there are just so many parts of the American mosaic and the international mosaic, for that matter. And it's our role in the press to try by fits and starts to figure out what that is.
I think we have about 12 minutes. I'm looking at this watch because I have told you I've been threatened by, I won't mention who in the audience, but somebody's very, that's a joke, folks. But we've got a lot of ground to cover, and this is critical stuff. You mentioned the informed citizens. You just mentioned that. Obviously, that was a key concept of the founders of this country. Representative government would work if we had informed citizens who then acted on their knowledge and views and elected people. How are you doing with that in terms of the media? You're in journalism for that purpose. You just said you wanted the citizens to be informed about things that are vital. You're in public media. You worked in private media. Is there a difference? Did ratings drive private media? Yeah. How does that affect? Is it the same in your world? And the overarching question, cumulatively, how are we doing to create an informed citizenry that the founders pledged their lives and their sacred honor, and I'm missing their fortunes, lives, and sacred honor in the Declaration of Independence?
That's a big question. It's okay. Actually two questions. How are we doing at informing the American people? I would say we've got a long way to go. I mean, we try to reach, and I mean all of us in the media who are trying mightily. Most people I know who work in journalism give it their all every day. They show up, and in fact, we don't just show up. We never stop working. I mean, thanks to the modern media, the cycle doesn't. There is no news cycle anymore. News is coming constantly. From the moment we open our eyes in the morning, we're working until we close our eyes at night virtually, because we have to be responsive to what's going on around us, and technology brings us information all the time, thanks to those devices like the one that you and I were looking at a few minutes ago, our smartphones and whatever other device we're watching. Having said that, do I think we're reaching most people? We're reaching many people. We're reaching people who are paying attention and wanting information, who want to be engaged. Do I wish we were reaching more? Absolutely. Look at the number of people who vote. I mean, that's one measure.
Exactly correct. We're roughly 12% in municipal elections, and if we get 60%...
Small percentages turn out to vote for school board, city, right. State. People do turn out in larger percentages to vote for president. That's when we get the bigger numbers. But even then, it's still not all Americans.
60% is considered successful.
60% is considered successful there. I mean, we've had elections where it was under 50%. And, you know, we want more people voting. We want our elections to reflect the will, the thinking of the American people. So from that standpoint, we're not reaching all those people. I mean, they're not all reading a newspaper or watching or listening or catching up with the news every day. They're doing the best they can. People have to go about their lives. They have to, you know, put food on the table for their kids, drive their kids to school, go to their job. You know, there's just so many things in people's lives. They don't have time to follow the news all day long.
Okay, but not all day long. I'm talking about when they do look at the news.
When they do look at the news.
What do you see in the private sector news system where you're seeing cutbacks in staffing, reduced reporting?
You're seeing
sensationalist news.
Newspapers shutting down all over the country, cutting back on reporting staff. People are hurt by that. Television news, I think, in general, commercial television news, is doing reasonably well, but even they've been affected by the technology explosion. Now everything is online. People are following news not by appointment viewing, by watching a particular show. They're following it on their computer or their smartphone or their tablet. So we're having to bring the news to you, the public. I think there's an opportunity now for our younger generation to get, for more of them to be informed. Because even though sometimes we get the sense they don't pay attention, they are hearing about things. And they are, I see evidence that this younger generation does follow what's happening around the world. That they're watching when, you know, there's a famine somewhere on the African continent, or when something happens with regard to same-sex marriage in this country, or if there's another controversial issue, young people will key in and express an opinion. And I think it's because they do have that little device they're carrying around. And so my hope is that through the entertainment channels that they're following, that some news and public affairs gets in there as well. Because it's there, and if we can just keep our education system strong, and that's another whole subject of conversation and debate, and keep that strong, make sure they learn how to read and write and follow what's going on in the world around them and care about what's going on in the world around them, then I think we have a chance that the next generation will be even better informed and will be active citizens in this country.
I have a quote from Dan Rather from 2009, and I'm going back to something you said in another discussion today about ratings and people taking them very seriously because they need to in commercial broadcasting. He said, in the current model of corporate news ownership, the incentive to produce good and valuable news is simply not there. Is he going too far? Is that statement
There's fair? Certainly been an undermining in commercial media, broadcast media, of what is valuable information. Why? Because it's a business. I mean, they want to keep people watching. We call it the eyeball count. You know, they're watching how many eyeballs are following what they're doing. And there's a temptation to go to what we call the lowest common denominator. You go to shows that are purely about celebrities or about reality show, entertainment kinds of programming, which a lot of people like to watch. It's easy to watch. You don't have to, you don't have to sit there and follow something very hard. You don't have to think a lot about it. Mm-hmm. And granted, we do need to relax sometimes. We don't all need to be, busy working constantly, worrying about whether we know the ins and outs of trade policy or what's happening in the Middle East. Having said that, enough of us as citizens do need to know that. And so that's why these news organizations should be held accountable. They should be trying to cover these stories, and they should be trying to figure out ways to make them interesting so more people will watch. So I think Dan Rather has a point. I'm not going to sit here and condemn all of commercial television or commercial radio. They do some things well and other things not so well. But I think it's kind of a let a thousand flowers bloom. It's why we need public media. We need public media because for us, the clear mission is education, information, cultural and entertainment programming that's uplifting, that raises you up, that gives you a sense of possibility, that brings up great writing, great music, great art, great drama. And that's who we are. That's what we're about in public media.
You have an hour format. Does the data show that people listen to your show a fairly long period of time, the average listener?
Is it what? I'm sorry?
Excuse me. You have a one-hour format.
Right.
Does the data show that people take advantage of that format?
Right.
That's a long newscast.
It's a long newscast, and we try to take advantage of that every night. You subtract a little bit of time for promotion, and some. We give credit to the folks who underwrite our program, provide funding. But yes, we try to pack into that 55 minutes or however 53 minutes, whatever it is, as much news and information as we can, and we want to make it as interesting as we can. My wonderful colleague Robin McNeil, at one point when he was pressed on it, said, sometimes we dare to be dull. We talk about those subjects that nobody else wants to talk about, whether it's, like I said, the Middle East or,
right.
Talk about education policy, immigration policy. Some of these things can get in the weeds, talking about the economy. But you know what? They matter. And we like to spend time on them occasionally, digging deeper and spending more time informing you, giving you a broader, deeper sense of these stories. We think that's our obligation. We try to do it in an interesting way. We don't want you sitting out there saying, oh my gosh, not another 5 or 10 minutes on monetary policy. But sometimes it matters, and sometimes we do it because we know it matters.
Tonight you had a segment on Bangladesh factory that collapsed some years back, and it is, I think it's clearly the only media that would carry that story at the depth that you did.
Yeah,
I thought it was a reflection of the dimensionality of what you do. How has it been for you as a woman reporter? You came in early, you've been involved in major reporting since 77. I know you were involved in covering Governor Carter, right?
Yeah, I was.
How has that been for you? Because you were pioneering, I'd say, in the broadcast industry, one of the pioneers. Is that fair?
Well, I was a pioneer for sure. I mean, I don't go back to the covered wagons, but sometimes I feel like I go almost back that far. There weren't very many, as I mentioned, there weren't that many role models. There were a couple of women. There were so few, I could count them on one hand. There was a woman named Pauline Frederick who covered the United Nations for NBC. And then there were one or two others, but not very many. I will say, I've told the story since I've been back in Billings, things, but when I first had a job as a secretary in the newsroom of a television station in Atlanta, I started bugging the news director to let me go out and follow the news crews around. Because my job was to answer the phone and clean the film, which is what we used went to shoot a story. And his answer to me was, Judy, why? Why do you want to do this? We already have a woman reporter, which was true. We had a woman reporter. But hey, we could manage two. So there were very few, and in the beginning they kind of pitted women against another. There'd be one woman. When I first went to cover the White House, there was one other woman covering the White House for NBC. So actually I was the second one. She was the senior and I was kind of, there was a guy and then I was the third man on the totem pole. I was assigned to weekends and mornings. And there was one woman at each network covering the White House, kind of a womaner covering the Hill. No women were covering the Pentagon, State Department. Today, there are women covering for print and television. Women are covering politics. Women are covering, every aspect of America, of Washington, D.C. There are more women today covering war zones around the world. Think about it. When you see some of the reporting we do, we've got some phenomenal correspondents covering the Middle East and other parts of the world for us who are women, who happen to be women. So women have come a long way. We still need to see more women in management, making decisions, figuring out who gets hired, you know, who gets to cover this story or that story. But we have come a very long way. I have to tell you my story a few years ago when we... At some point, about 10 or 12 years ago, the number of women local anchors overtook the number of women of men local anchors. But my explanation for that was it looks like a man and his second wife, because the guys were allowed to get older and have gray hair. The women had to be in their 20s, frankly. Fortunately, that's changing. You're looking at somebody who's not in her 20s.
But you look like you're in your 20s.
No.
But, now you're 20s, your 40s.
But my point is that young women can now come along in journalism and see people like me and say, oh, okay, I'm not going to be fired or shown the door when I'm 30 or 40 or older or 50. I can keep going. So thank goodness for that.
Now you've been a political correspondent for over 40 years at a high level.
Yeah.
What's your assessment of politics now? Looking back at that 40-year period, what's going on and why?
It's a blood sport today. It's mean-spirited. It's always been divided. When I first came to Washington, Republicans and Democrats, you'd go out to dinner, there'd be Republicans and Democrats together, breaking bread, having a glass of wine, discussing and arguing even, having even heated arguments. But at the end of the day, they'd be, you know, in the gym at the House of Representatives or the Senate, shooting baskets together, trading stories. They brought their spouses to Washington. Their children went to school together. Today, you don't see them together. They don't know each other. They come into Washington on Mondays. They leave on Thursday night. They come in on Monday night. They leave on Thursday night. Most of them don't bring their families. They don't know each other socially. It's gotten so bad that now some members are trying to break through that, and they will. They've started up some basketball pickup games occasionally now, and they'll say, you know, we're doing this so we can spend a little bit of time if you're an R, you spend a little bit of time with some D's and vice versa. But it's just gotten much meaner. There are terrible motives ascribed to the other party.
Right.
People are called, unpatriotic if they disagree with somebody else. And it's not good for our democracy. And I hope the younger generation figures out a way to fix it.
A phenomenon seems to me, looking around the world, that we're seeing a resurgence in authoritarian or totalitarian governments. In Europe, it has obviously a history of fascism that led to World War II. You've got the government in Poland, the government in Hungary has been written about, the recent Italian elections. And in this country, you've had initially during the Trump administration, white supremacists becoming more visible.
Right.
Madeleine Albright recently wrote a book, and she thinks we're headed toward fascism is the word that she used. It's not a word that's commonly used in the media. What's your sense for that? Anti-immigrant? nationalist, militarist, that sort of concept that is fascist in nature,
And I look forward to interviewing Madeleine Albright in another couple of weeks about her book. I think she acknowledges in the book that she paints a pretty stark picture in order to get people's attention, because she is concerned about some of these tendencies that you've described around the world. And she does talk about, I haven't finished reading the book, I just barely have started it, but she talks in the book about what's changed in this country and the rising levels of intolerance. Mm-hmm. I think that is clearly something we have to be on guard against. It has been with us always, you could say. I mean, think of the Oklahoma City bombing. It was a domestic terrorist who was responsible for that. There have always been pockets of groups in this country of people who didn't believe in integration, didn't believe in civil rights movement, don't like immigrants, and today they absolutely believe we've gone too far with immigration and we've let too many people come in. We've broken the pure Anglo-Saxon tradition, and we need to do something about it. Fortunately, those people are very much in the minority, but they are here. They're present in our midst, and I think all of us need to be conscious of it. We need to talk about it. We need to get it out in the open, and we in the media need to report on it so that people can be not only be aware that it's there, but talk among ourselves about what our values are, what matters to us. Does it matter to us that there are people getting elected to a city council or a school board or a state legislature who hold these very extreme views on the right or on the left? I mean, wherever they're coming from, we need to talk about all that. Sure, I worry. I mean, I look at what's happening in Europe. I know what's happening in this country. I wouldn't go as far, I think, as Secretary Albright has. I think, as I said, I think she wanted to be provocative in her book. But I look forward to reading the book and talking to her about it. And she is, I think, one of the great shining lights of American diplomacy. I mean, here she was, one of the first women to be Secretary of State. Yep. And we've now had a number of women follow in her footsteps, and so she's made history.
I see we're out of time. I very much regret it, and I appreciate so much your being with us and being
in
Montana.
Thank you, Brian.
Now the
I
audience is
going
to ask questions.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Great. I look forward. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it. I'm going to ask for the lights to go up so I can see you. You're all kind of in the dimness out there in the dark. So if we can have the lights up. And then are you calling on people?
I'm not sure. The people in the audience have microphones, so just raise your hand. We've got microphones walking around.
Okay. There's a gentleman
not microphones
right,
walking around. People walk
gentleman
around with
right
microphones.
Here.
Right up front.
Hi. My question concerns Facebook and how Facebook is affecting our society, affecting the degree of polarization, and affecting the way we see many segments of our society.
Well, Facebook, as everybody knows, has been in the news recently with all the revelation, well, not just recently, but they've been in the news for the last couple of years, really since the middle of the 2016 election, as we learned about how Facebook used so-called algorithms to determine what goes into people's news feeds. I have to, full disclosure, because of my somewhat public role, I have not used Facebook regularly. I do have a page on Facebook, but I don't turn to it all the time because I couldn't ever figure out how to do personal, private, public, and the rest of it together. That's full disclosure. But of course, as I'm very aware, all the members of my family use Facebook. It's how family members communicate with each other. It's very much alive and present in my world and in the worlds of my children and colleagues at work. So Facebook has been in the news. They've been in the middle of this controversy. I don't think they are single-handedly responsible for the polarization that we are seeing, but there's no question that they and other social media platforms contributed to it. How? Because they were giving us information that they thought we were most interested in or that most met our needs as a political creature. And so what did that mean? That meant we were reading stories. If we tended to lean a little to the right, we were reading more stories to the right. If we leaned to the left, we're reading more stories to the left. The same thing was happening on other social platforms. They are now trying to correct that by being more neutral. They're trying to come up with new news feeds, original news feeds. They're talking to news organizations. We are one of many news organizations they're talking to about how to get the news out to people, but it's complicated and it's still very much in the early stages, behind closed doors, so I'm not in a position to share with you where it's going. But I will say this, I think the result of everything we've seen on Facebook, what Cambridge Analytica did, this group, that mysterious group that was based in London that it turned out was helping the Trump campaign, other news organizations, other non-news organizations out there that were trying to create false stories, what the Russians did in trying to create false stories, and successfully creating false stories. All of that, what does it add up to? It adds up to the fact that all of you, us in the media, we've got to be much more informed and responsible for the news that we consume. We can no longer be passive news consumers, just like back in the day when I sat as a teenager in front of a TV set watching Walter Cronkite narrate the John Kennedy assassination aftermath and funeral. We can't be just passive consumers. We've got to look carefully at what we're reading, what we're picking up and reading, if we still read a newspaper as I do, whether we read it online, follow social media, your Facebook feed, Twitter, whatever, wherever you get your news from. You need to carefully look at where it's coming from, who wrote it, what news organization was behind it, and if something looks fishy, check it out. But more than ever, I think we need to rely on news sources we can trust. That's why I think the News Hour, to pat us on the back for just a second, is more valuable than ever today. It's why I think our audience numbers are up, because I think, thank you. People want a place that they can trust, that they know that has vetted the information, that has confirmed it, checked it at least twice before they just throw it on the air or put every rumor out there. We all have got to be more careful. And that means, as I say, more responsibility for you as news consumers.
Other questions?
Anybody else?
Sir? Microphone down
here. Here's another gentleman up front right here.
And maybe someone else can raise a hand so that we're kind of on track.
There's another one.
Right off.
Okay, Judy, you know, I'm sorry you come into my room every day, so I'm sorry.
Please call me Judy. Thank you.
Okay.
And what's your name?
Bernie. One of the things that's really interesting to me, and I'm going to change the subject, is how you put this together. And I think about Amy Walters and Tamara Keith, who's on Monday, Tamara had a baby. Or
She had a baby on Friday.
She did. Or Shields and Brooks. And I wonder how you put that together. It's not a regular interview.
It's different.
Do you consult back and forth on the questions? I know you don't rehearse, but...
No, we don't rehearse. We do have... It's different for both segments. We start talking a couple of days, or really it gets more intense the day before, because frankly, there's just so much news going on now. There's less several days ahead going on for these segments, because they tend to be, with Shields and Brooks, we're looking at the news of the week, of the previous week. And with Politics Monday, we're looking kind of at what happened over the weekend, because there does tend to be news that happened that day, that Monday, and over the weekend. But the thinking behind Shields and Brooks is, here are two really, really, really smart guys who come at our whatever's going on in Washington and around the country and around the world, who come at it from different perspectives. Mark obviously leans left, David leans right, but neither one of them is a knee-jerk Democrat or Republican with talking points from each party. They are both perfectly comfortable challenging the orthodoxy of their political party, conservative, liberal, Democrat, Republican. They are perfectly comfortable of standing up to whatever the party line is. That's what I love about them, that they are unpredictable. And I think that's the enduring strength and appeal of that segment, that they are not two people who will, you know, you're not going to hear talking points from them, which I think you often hear when you turn on other channels and you hear a Republican and a Democrat, and you can almost turn the sound off and you know kind of what they're going to say. It's not the way, not the case with Mark and David. You're going to hear something different. But we do start consulting the day before. I'll say, you know, I probably want to ask you about the, for example, the week, the Jim Comey book. We'll probably talk about the Jim Comey book, what he said, the reaction to it. Probably want to talk about, I don't know, maybe there was a North Korea development. But beyond that, I don't get very much into it because I want to let them think about what they want to say. And then I try to keep the questions broad because I don't want to try to say, all right, was it right for the president to say this specific sentence and then quote the sentence? I want to leave it open for them so we can have kind of a broad and interesting conversation. Tamara Keith and Amy, and Amy Walter, again, it's, okay, we're probably going to talk about the fact that, I mean, I didn't do the segment tonight because I was here in Montana, but if I had been talking to them, I'd be interested in knowing why the president's nominee to be the next Secretary of Veterans Affairs, the White House physician, Ronnie Jackson, who it turns out has never run anything larger than the White House medical staff of 60 or 70 people, has been chosen to run this agency of second largest agency after the Pentagon, I think 600,000 or 700,000 employees, or maybe more than that. His nomination has been slowed down. I'd want to talk to them about why that is. Talk about where, you know, the nomination of Mike Pompeo to be Secretary of State. It did come through. It did get passed favorably out of the Foreign Relations Committee today. I'd want to talk to them maybe about that. Every week is different. When we get closer to the midterm elections, we'll do a lot of talking about that. Amy is a specialist in American the American political architecture. She studies every congressional district, every Senate race, every governor's race. She studies polling. She's kind of a walking, breathing encyclopedia of American politics. I love talking to her. I can practically raise any race in the country, and she will know something about it. She'll know how much money was spent, you know, who the politician is married to, how many children they have, whether they have a dog or not, and so on. But she's just great. And Tam is just a terrific reporter. She came up through the ranks at NPR. She's young. She's really smart. And she's learned in just a matter of a few years how to take that reporting information and weave it into a kind of an interesting analysis where she's got kind of a bird's eye view. So she's one cut above a reporter, but she's not giving her opinion. She's giving you her informed analysis. And I think it works so well with Amy. And hey, they're two women. And so that's great. You know, Mark and David on Fridays, Tam and Amy on Mondays.
There was somebody in the middle here. Over here? Okay.
I can yell.
All right, why don't you yell?
Right here.
He asked about what are the three or four most important things that matter now.
Well, what always matters to me is the well-being of the American people. You know, how is the economy doing? If there's an economy story, if there's something that has happened. I mean, right now the economy seems to be doing overall pretty well after the terrible recession, the crash of 2008, and the recession, which, you know, we all watched it together. The country's come roaring back. We now interest rates. The Federal Reserve is comfortable raising interest rates again. They're starting to try to see whether inflation is coming back. But interest rates are going up. That's what we're... So we're always watching the economy. If there's an economy story, we know that touches all of us. It touches all of our lives. I care about education a lot. If there's something happening in American education, and that's why we have a committed segment every week to education. We call it Making the Grade. We've given it a title, and we look at higher ed, we look at K-12, any aspect of educating children from the time they're out of the womb to the time to adults and the time we go to the grave, cradle to grave education. We are committed to looking at that. I could go on and name all the other things that I think are important. I think we have to pay attention to science. We have a weekly segment on science in all of its forms and iterations. We have segments on the arts regularly. Beyond that, politics in all of its forms. I think we have to hold our elected officials accountable, from the president to the members of Congress to our governors, our mayors. It's hard for us to do that from Washington. We count on reporters in places like Helena, Billings, Missoula, here in Montana, to hold your local officials, state and local officials accountable. And we in Washington try to hold the best job we can, but it's a tough slog. I mean, there's an entire administration. There's a president who I believe as long as I've been in Washington, I think the president has been overcovered. I think there's too many reporters covering the White House, too many people just all doing the same thing, showing a camera, following the president around. I think there's too much of that. I think we duplicate, we overlap, and what's missing? We don't do enough covering of the agencies of government. We sort of cover the leadership of Congress, the big stories out of Congress, but we don't cover the little stories in Congress that really matter. When the lobbying happens, when the money that affects the lobbying changes votes or doesn't, we're not covering that enough. We're not covering what's going on in the Veterans Administration, in the Pentagon. Yes, we're trying around the edges, but we're not doing enough of it. It's because I think there's this fascination with the person of the president. And yes, particularly right now, we have someone who is a phenomenal success at being a TV star. I mean, he was a TV star before he came to the White House. He's still a TV star. He knows how to be a TV star. He knows how to attract a lot of attention. And we are spending a whole lot of time on television, print, Twitter, Facebook, and everything else following him. I hope we're also shining a light on other places as well as we cover him.
Hi, Judy. Thank you for coming back to Montana. I have daughters. I also have a niece who's a journalism student in University of Montana in Missoula. Great. Thank you for being a role model for young women. I'm greatly grateful for that as a mother. I was reminded tonight to get here on time because I was listening to the 6 o'clock news, and your new news anchor said Judy Woodruff is away. And I remembered that I had to get her, and she's not away from me if I get down there. So I get to hear your voice tonight again, so thank you. My question really is, Barbara Bush, the late First Lady Barbara Bush, having just been laid to rest, this is the first weekday since her funeral, and her legacy being one of literacy for children. It's sort of a coincidence that you're here in Montana on this literacy theme because of the events benefiting the library. Is that a coincidence, or is there something you have to relay regards to that?
With regard to media, with regard to literacy, no, other than the fact that I support, of course, I love the fact that today I was able to do an event at the Billings Public Library. I was able to get a great tour. You are so fortunate in this community to have that amazing place and all that it offers. Oh my goodness, it is just amazing. I tweeted about it. I tweeted and a picture of the library, and I said, this is a library that engages kids of all ages, because I love the children's section, but I also, of course, love the part for teenagers and adults and old people like me, and you know, it's really inspiring. I wish, and I gather it's won all kinds of awards. So I'm hoping that communities around the country that have kind of let their libraries get run down or haven't had the funding to keep their libraries going, that they find a way to do that, because it's so critically important, especially that you touch those kids in your community and every community who may not have access to books, to literacy, to the things that I think some of us take for granted. They may not have that access, and if we can give them that through the public library or other ways to expose them to books, expose them to great literature as they make their way through school, we're better off as a country. We have to continue to put so much emphasis on education in this country. It's critically important. It sets us apart from other nations. We struggle in some regards, but we still, I think, I celebrate teachers every day. My sister was a teacher. It was her career. She taught for over 25 years in the public schools in Augusta, Georgia.
What level of grade?
Worked.
What grade level was she teaching?
She taught high school social studies in an inner city school. And she, more nights, more days than not, she was there after school working with those kids on every, and she worked with them on math quizzes, even though she taught social studies. She tried she gave it her all. And on a salary, you know, that it was just never enough. I mean, I always was angry at the school systems around the country. I love the fact that teachers are out there marching in state after state, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Arizona, Kentucky. And I know there are different reasons in different places why salaries are not higher than they are, but for goodness sake, these are the people who are touching the lives of our next generation. We need to make it possible for them to continue to teach, and we need to be paying them more. We need to be paying our childcare workers more than we do. Those are the jobs to me that matter so much in these health, of course, and education. And I worry so much that they are overlooked and not given the recompense, the remuneration that they deserve.
I was just told that was the last question. So.
Oh, we can take one more.
One more.
Yes.
Got
no
one
more questions. Right, no more. Well, if we don't have another question, it's okay. Right there.
I just wanted to say, I'm sure like everybody else, we all love team of you and Gwen.
Oh, thank you.
And we still all miss Gwen. And I just wondered professionally what it was like going from being a co-anchor to sort of a solo anchor, almost professionally. And if you think there's any likelihood of another co-anchor coming along.
Well, it's been thank you for that question. It's been it was and is a very tough thing. Gwen Ifill, I know all of you know Gwen, were named co-anchors of the NewsHour after Jim Lehrer retired. We were named in 2013, and it was the great professional joy and personal joy of my life because she was my dear friend as well as being my colleague. Gwen was larger than life. She represented everything wonderful and amazing about journalism. She was not only brilliant, she was engaged. She was a tough reporter, but a tough reporter with heart. And it was just it was magical being able to work with her. And we lost her much too early. It was a shock. We thought she was going to come back from her cancer diagnosis, but it wasn't meant to be. I would say because we didn't have a succession plan in place at that time, we decided to take our time and not rush into a decision. And then we made the decision, it probably made sense to continue to sort of go back to the Jim Lehrer model. Jim, for many years, was the anchor of the program and had a group of wonderful correspondents working around him. Gwen, Jeffrey Brown, Ray Suarez, who was with us for many years before he moved on to Al Jazeera, Margaret Warner. We are now have a wonderful, established, and growing group of correspondents. Jeffrey Brown is still with us. John Yang has done amazing anchor work for us. William Brangham, who came to us from New York, has a distinguished career. And we've just brought on board two other correspondents, Amna Nawaz, who filled in tonight as an anchor. We've just brought Amna on in the last few weeks. And we've also brought on another young man who's been doing contract correspondent work for us, Nick Schifrin. And so we're going to kind of keep this plan for a little bit longer. And then at some point when it feels right, we will bring in either a co-anchor or we'll go to a new anchor. It's all kind of in the mix. Right now we are going with a solo anchor. It hasn't been easy. I would much, much, much rather have Gwen still with us, clearly. I mean, that to me, when Gwen and I were together, we thought we'd be there for the foreseeable future. And I frankly thought, you know, I'm older than Gwen. I thought I'll be the one to step aside and she'll continue with someone else. You know, we all never know. We never know what the future's going to bring. We can't possibly know. But I will tell you this, that I carry with me every day, reminder of Gwen and what she stood for. And I feel very blessed to have been able to work with her. But thank you for the question. I appreciate it.
I have a final question, despite the rule. I appreciate that.
I've got a young man here that I got one last question. We'll make him the last audience question, and then we'll give it back to you.
Please.
I'm a writer for a school newspaper here in Billings at a Catholic school. I was wondering if you had any advice for young journalists.
We need you. Or as I said at another occasion when I was asked by a young person like you, jump in, the water's fine. We need you. Journalism is going through a lot of changes right now. We don't know exactly what it's going to look like by the time. How old are you? What year in school are you?
I'm 12.
You're 12. So you are 7th grade?
6th
grade.
Yeah.
In 6 years, when you graduate from high school, and then 4-plus years after that, when you finish college or graduate school or whatever you choose to do, I don't know what journalism is going to look like. I know, though, that we are always going to need journalists in this country. We're going to need great writers, great reporters. Why? Because that's what our democracy depends on. The founding fathers, bless them, they were just men. They did a pretty good job of coming up with this thing called the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. Bless them. And they included a free press in that First Amendment. Thank goodness they did it, because it's true. We need, along with all the other freedoms that are so important to our democracy, we must have a free press. And how can we have a free press? Because smart young people like you decide that they're going to go into journalism, that you're going to go out there, you're going to ask tough questions, you're going to write those stories, and whether you deliver them so that I can see them on my wristwatch, or on my tablet, or my smartphone, or on a screen, or whether I read them on a piece of paper, we're going to need your reporting. We need journalists to come and join us and do this important work of reporting on what's going on around us. Do it without fear or favor. Tell the truth as you see it, and let the public make up its own mind. We're always going to need that kind of journalism, so I encourage you. I encourage you. Thank you for the question.
That young man's question was better than the one I was going to ask. We're going to end with that. Thank you so much, Judy, for being here.
Well, we let this young man in. Thank you.